You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 3rd of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 304 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll meet philosopher Julian Baggini, the man who's making life's big questions smaller and easier to understand, such as the notion of free will. Do we control our own destinies? We'll find out a little later.
And we'll hear from journalist and academic Brian Cathcart about the history of the profession and why the truth hasn't always got in the way of a good story.
And a possible first for the Monocle Weekly, football, Andrew. We'll meet Heidi Blake, the co-author of a new book on Qatar's scandalous journey to hosting the World Cup.
All that, plus Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli will be here with the news look ahead, and we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Edition 304, Andrew. That number is more impressive each week, quite literally, because it goes up by one.
Yeah, have you noticed that? It just ticks up by one each week.
I know, it's amazing. The passage of time and all that. Passage of time this week, another busy one at Midori House.
A nice evening, though, for a kind of a 1 week ahead of the UK election. We asked a bunch of ambassadors. Do you call them a bunch of ambassadors?
I believe that's the collective.
No, I'm not sure what the collective, a bunch of ambassadors, we'll have to think about that one. We asked a bunch of ambassadors, some foreign correspondents, some bigwigs and some friends of the family to come here for a dinner to discuss what the shape of Britain might look like in a week's time. And we had the ambassadors of Sweden and Japan and Polly Toynbee from The Guardian. And lots of people came here and it was good.
Really interesting evening. And interesting insights. And it's funny, there's a palpable sense now. I mean, I guess the whole campaign season in the UK is a lot shorter than compare it to, say, a presidential race in the US that stretches out over years. It is basically a month of frenzied campaigning, but there's a real feeling, I don't know, as we ease now into what the last kind of 4 or 5 days, it's something quite exciting is unfolding, I think.
This morning, we were discussing some of the debates that have been happening over the past week to do with the UK election. There was a good one last Thursday night. It wasn't a one head-on-head, but it was intriguing that the public in the final days got to ask some very direct questions, and they kind of landed more punches than the journalists have done over the past few weeks, I think.
I don't know what that tells us. Maybe we should ask Brian Cathcart about that a little later. In terms of close to home, another magazine.
Another magazine out
off the
door with... what a year it's proving to be. This year, we've produced 4 travel guidebooks, 2 of which are just about to come out, and then another 2 come out in about 8 weeks' time. We've just about finished the big book on homes and architecture that'll be out in the summer. We've had the conference.
A small matter of the conference.
What more could you want?
I tell you what more I could ask for, Andrew, and we can serve it up right now. An audience with Daniel Giacopelli.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love
The Monocle Weekly has some really great minds. Some really great minds, Andrew. Great, you know, philosophical thinkers. That's Julian Baggini. He'll be on in a little moment, a little while.
What's singing the song?
First up, here's Danny Giacopelli.
We love you more each day,
Your
Danny.
Your wit never fails to amaze me, Tom.
He's quite funny.
Never disappoints.
What have you got for us, Danny?
I have a lot of silly stuff, actually. It's kind of different from my normal routine of very serious things, as you know.
Well, it's supposed to be kind of a blend of light and shade, Danny.
Is that what it... Well, I decide what it's supposed to be.
This will be the first time that you haven't got the Iranian nuclear talks in there, is it?
I have an Iran story in here.
Oh,
I do.
Okay, good. All right,
well, let's start with the serious. The UK, obviously... is having an election next week.
Mm. Yeah, we've just been talking about
on the
that.
7th, right.
It's on Thursday.
Indeed. Who's going to win?
Well, define win, because that's what we're saying. You may be the biggest party, but you may not have enough small parties to form a coalition. How crazy that, you know, we had like 50 years of non-coalition politics, and then suddenly it's kind of...
Well, the whole system is kind of predicated on somebody winning outright. But maybe democracy will be the winner.
Oh, God.
Well, maybe. I think it's...
I don't know. Maybe democracy will be the loser.
Probably the loser. Okay, let's get into the silly. I promo
that
this
was,
last
that
week.
One serious item. That was.
And I think the UK election is quite silly. But anyway, yeah. Move on.
As I kind of foreshadowed last week, it's Hedgehog Awareness Week this week.
Say hedgehog again.
Hedgehog.
It makes it sound like a big pig in the field. Doesn't it? Here comes a hedgehog.
I definitely don't sound that.
Get your guns out.
Yeah, I didn't realise.
No, we're being mean to lovely
South
Danny.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
So we just need to be aware of the hedgehogs. Is there any
just
what's
be
the other requirement?
Aware of their presence. Aware of their presence. On the 4th of May, in a couple of days, it's the...
is that the end of the story?
It's the Stilton cheese rolling competition.
What if you rolled a Stilton cheese
into a hedgehog?
This is
actually
a famous
event.
You wouldn't have to get the cocktail sticks out, would you?
It's quite a good idea.
That's good. That's pretty good.
Just get the hedgehog, put the little bits of Stilton on its back. It could walk around at the party.
That's very clever.
Yeah.
We should patent that.
This is a famous event, though, right? I mean, I think it's famous. I see it.
Define famous.
Well, whenever it happens, you see photos.
Well, I think that there are
a few... You roll it down a hill.
Yeah. I think, if I'm not incorrect, that different towns have different cheeses to roll. Mm. I think there's a few places that like to roll a cheese. Stilton may be out there in the lead. Because the good thing about Stilton is it's kind of crusty on the outside, but it's kind of got softness inside. So it's got momentum.
I like how he starts off this by saying, I don't know much about Stilton, but let me tell you everything that there is to know about it.
I imagine it probably is quite a competitive field. If there's any cheesemongers or experts listening, get in touch with us.
Speaking of competitive, on the 9th, it's the annual Giro d'Italia cycling race.
Oh, that's a proper event.
Right. And you're a cycling fan.
I am.
So tell us about the race. I know nothing about this race. I know it...
Well, it's one of the Grand Tours. I mean, it's one of the Grand Tours. So the European 20 season days long. Features, yeah, a number of... I mean, the Tour de France is the most famous, but for many connoisseurs, you know, they find more delights on the Giro. It's one of the most testing. And hopefully this year we'll get a lot of the leading riders. They think they might contest all the Grand Tours. Normally they have to not do one just for their own physical, you know, for the endurance that's involved. But the Giro is one of the great ones. You know, Italy is beautiful. There's mountains. You've got all sorts.
And is there a sense that, you know, after all the drug scandals and the, you know, the doping incidents and after Mr. Armstrong's departure, that the sport has cleaned itself up?
It's sort of fallen on a few individuals or particular teams to really lead the way. There's still swirling accusations about some riders. You still find the odd people who are failing drugs tests. I don't think the sport has managed to purge itself of those problems. But if there's one or two small instances, I think you'll find most aficionados are willing to overlook them simply because the sheer impressiveness of the feats are so extraordinary. That, you know, what these guys can do day after day after day on these Grand Tours is quite remarkable.
See, now that's a...
Especially with steroids.
Oh, no, see, why'd you have to ruin it with that?
No. But that's... You've made me want to watch it.
Yeah. It's inspirational stuff. Tune in if you can.
Okay.
I wonder if they dope test the Stilton rollers.
Or the hedgehogs.
They probably did. No, let's move on.
This is a bit silly, but kind of awesome at the same time. It's Donkey Week next week.
Danny, where are you finding
and
these
things? Let me describe the what happens during
what
Donkey Week.
What speciality websites are you going on?
I thought you called them an ass in America.
Well, so visits to the farms, most of which are usually not open to the public, are held. So-called donkey weekers can groom, cuddle, or just sit and watch the donkeys
donkey
enjoying
what?
The
donkey?
Spring sunshine.
They're donkey what?
Groomers?
Donkey groomers.
Donkey weekers can groom.
Donkey weekers? Are those people
they can do groom.
Those who attend Donkey Week, I suppose.
Okay, Donkey weekers.
So is there ass week in the US? An ass...
Have you attended?
Well,
I'm sure you've been called an ass weeker before.
Is this allowed? Can we see?
It's allowed.
Okay.
I think he's actively encouraged.
Good. Look at Danny's getting all pink. One final one. Give us one final one.
Well, there's World Water Bombing Championships.
What?
There's the Real Bread Week or my favourite, British Sandwich Week.
British Sandwich Week. That would be... I think that would be dull, I think. That's
probably
not very good. But what was the Iranian one? What was the Iranian one?
Fine, so it's the Iran oil show in Tehran.
Sounds pretty slick.
I kid you not. I don't know what happened at an oil show. Do they kind of just have barrels and people, you know, judge it like they judge hogs at farms in Iowa? I don't know. But there we are.
Okay.
We should send someone.
Maybe you should go. Maybe you should go for a few weeks and come back.
I'll get sent to Evan Prison.
Okay. Well, Danny, thank you very much. And that's why we love you a little bit more each week.
This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Now, Julian Maggini is a philosopher who's thinking about the choices we make and whether they're truly our own or the product of the societies we inhabit.
Whether you see human decision-making as a purely scientific occurrence or believe that the mind is a more mystical and unexplainable piece of apparatus, it can't be denied that many everyday actions, such as ideas or speech, occur with very little preemptive thought indeed. It's debates such as these that comprise Julian's new book, Freedom Regained, The Possibility of Free Will. And he's here now to tell us more. Julian, before we can dive into the book, set out the reasons for it in a way, the argument that you're wading into, because you make it clear that in many instances, neuroscientists have kind of tried to say that we don't have free will. And you're kind of setting out your stall to say, actually, hold on, you haven't quite got this right.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's an important issue. It's one that actually, you know, I've found that a lot of, you know, public, for want of a better word, are interested in it, all kind of book talks. People often say, yeah, but what about free will? What about free will? And I think part of that concern is that from all sorts of different angles now, for various years, we've had people chipping away at the possibility of free will. So the most current thing, as you say, is neuroscience. So you keep hearing these reports which show that things are going on in the brain which we're not aware of, and these are the things really driving our decisions, not our conscious actions. But before that, we had genes. You know, so again, it's not anything to do with your free choice. You're genetically disposed to vote how you're going to vote in an election or to be religious or not. And before that, of course, we had a lot of cultural determinism that, you know, who you are and what you value is going to be a product basically of your socioeconomic situation. So all these things have accumulated. And I think a lot of people think, well, it really does look like one way or another, I'm just a kind of product of everything that's made me. And where does that leave the room for this free will?
And also, I guess it prompts the question, well, what do we understand by the term free will? I mean, is there a universally accepted notion of what that does mean, whether it's a relative concept, that construct? What do you mean when you use that, I guess?
Yeah, well, okay, that's the issue. I think you've got to define it well. And I think we tend to assume that free will is something that people naturally understand. Actually, if you look in history and other cultures, this kind of Western philosophical notion of free will isn't perhaps universal. But let's put it this way. I think that most people assume that at any given moment, you kind of have options. The future is open, and which future comes to be depends upon a choice that you make. And that choice isn't just simply the byproduct of everything else that's going on in the physical world and your history. That somehow you can kind of intervene in nature, if you like, to make a difference to how the future is going to be. That's, I think, the way people think about it. Kind of right and kind of wrong.
And Julian, one of the interesting sections in the book is about people who have diminished senses of freedom or who have felt to have diminished senses of freedom. The psychopath, for example. And then you also look at the addict who obviously is, to outsiders, controlled by a substance or a compulsion. Did you feel that this was, in a way, by saying, okay, here are examples of people where free will is working in a slightly different way, it actually allowed you to redefine it for the rest of us a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think part of the problem with the philosophical debate is that it's all got rather abstract. So if you read any kind of academic paper on whether you have free will, a typical thing will be, you know, do you have the tea or the coffee? You know, the bun or the donut. And okay, but actually that's not the most important choices we make in life. They're not even the most typical ones. So I wanted to bring it back to things we can recognise in the experience of life, which give us the archetypes both for positive freedom and for its absence. Now, addiction is a very interesting example, because I think a lot of people do have a misguided view of addiction, that basically the addict literally can't help themselves. So it's like their free will is turned off. Now, I think if you look at it more realistically, you talk to people who have addictions, you talk to people who work with people with addictions, it's clearly not like that. What happens in the case of an addict is that their capacity to make their own choices is vastly diminished. So it's like a turning down of our capacity of free will. And I think that's a really, really important clue, because I think if you want to really understand what free will is, you mustn't think of it as the magical ability we have to kind of make choices from nothing and alter the course of nature. It's something we have more or less of. And when we have more of it, it simply means that more of our choices are kind of in accordance with what we want and what we would want on reflection and are not simply automatic, unthinking responses to what goes on around us.
And it's here, I think, that you begin to spy why your book is so interesting and important, because I guess that if you're involved in the world of addiction, you're going to be diving into this debate because, you know, first, the addict who says, I can't do anything, you know, I have no control over my behavior, or the agency that is trying to deal with addicts who is saying, actually, we're not going to help you anymore because we think you can sort this out yourself. Yeah. In between those two worlds, you're diving in, and your seemingly philosophical stance on this, I presume, has real consequences.
Oh, I think it does. I think it's important politically as well, because I think, again, people tend to go to kind of two extremes. Stereotypically, conservatives tend to sort of basically think that people have this power of agency and there's no excuse for how they behave in terms of their economic position or anything else. You know, that's just an excuse. Everyone's responsible. On the other hand, I think sometimes, particularly in the past, the left has made the mistake of just seeing people as pure products of, you know, economic determinism in that kind of Marxist way, and lacking agency. Now, I think that the two extremes we need to avoid. What we need to always remember is that people are constrained in how they can choose depending upon all sorts of things, including their genes, including their upbringing, including their economic position. But all the time, what we want to try and do is to enable people to try and gain as much control over their choices as possible. And you don't do that when you make too much of what's not in their control. So, for example, in the case of the addict, in order for someone to overcome their addiction, they have to realise, in some sense, that they do have a capacity to act differently. And similarly, at Broadmoor, in order for any kind of, you know, serious violent criminal to be rehabilitated, that doesn't work if they just think, I couldn't help it, I was bound to do it, whatever. They have to rediscover their sense of agency, their control over themselves. So to me, it's all about, you know, trying to build within people that sense of control, enabling people to build their genuine free will.
Can I just ask then, you talk about the challenges of dealing with these notions in the abstract and then trying to write about them or apply them to real life. If you look at the example of someone in Broadmoor, for example, who's, you know, criminally, I don't know, insane, yeah, as we would have called it formerly, is it a question then of needing to come to some sort of philosophical understanding, or are there actual cognitive behavioural therapies to do this? Does someone need to have an appreciation of the philosophical points, the nuances of that position, to be able to grasp it so that they can then set about going on a course of treatment?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, it has to be said, there is a minority of people who are simply unresponsive to any kind of reason, argument, treatment, and those people you just treat as though it were an illness, and they're not really responsible, they're just sick. In those other cases, people don't need to understand the full nuance of the philosophical debate, for sure. But, I mean, talking to people, you know, senior psychiatrists who work with people in Broadmoor, and, of course, also with people who work in the addiction field, it does seem to be the case that they do, though, need to understand that they have this agency, let's put it that way. Mm. And that is a kind of philosophical way of looking at things. It's not just a matter of mastering some sort of cognitive techniques. That's got to cash out in terms of like feeling that, yes, you know, there is a real sense in which I am in control of my circumstances and not merely a slave to impulses, substances, whatever it might be.
You also look to other interesting examples where people have extended their freedom in some sense, you know, the dissident and the artist. And there we, you know, as outsiders, we look at these people and think, oh, they have a greater freedom than all of us, which is debatable. But if we concentrate on the dissident, I know there you think there's an interesting debate, because is political freedom the same as free will? What is it about the dissident that intrigued you for this book?
Well, what intrigues me about it is this extent to which, you know, if you go back to that philosophical definition of free will, it seems that people want freedom to be absolute. Unless all your values and choices are purely down to you and they're not forced upon you in any way at all, then you're not really free. Now, what makes the case of the dissident interesting, I think, is that the values which lead them to act are not things that they experience as things they have chosen, right? People often say, you know, when they stand up to, you know, authority, to stand up to pressure in that way, that they couldn't do otherwise, actually. Yeah, so the definition of free will is often the capacity to have done otherwise. But people often experience these great moments of heroism as, I could not have done otherwise. And I think that is an important clue, because I think that we have to accept the fact that often the things which most motivate us to act, the most motivate us to express what in one way seems like our freedom, are things which, in other respects, we perceive as necessities. Love is another very good, simple example. I mean, love would be meaningless if you could just choose anyone to love, right? Love has its power because when you really do love someone, that's something you experience as something you can't help but feel. That's what makes it so powerful. So then your freedom is about your ability to live according to that value, to express it, and to follow your path in that way. It's not the freedom to choose your fundamental values and who you love in the first place. So there are real important limits on what it makes sense to think you can choose. If we kind of instead set up the idea of freedom as being the capacity to choose everything of value in your life, then it soon becomes obvious that it's not only impossible, it's kind of incoherent and undesirable.
And I think you also say that it's important that we also yoke ourselves a little bit with the knowledge that you've given a good examples there where upbringing, who we are, culture probably restrict and govern some of the things we do. But within that, we have freedom. But on the other side, you say that there are also instances where I could go crazy in here now, or I could, you know, walk out, but you know, I don't. But that you don't say that's a lack of free will. You say we put on ourselves restrictions, but we understand them. So there is still free will.
Yeah, I think there's an extent to which, you know, a lot of freedom is about, true freedom is about sometimes recognizing limits that you want to stick to. And it's also sort of recognizing the fact that you then have to work within them. They're worth sticking to. It's interesting, again, it's not something I go into so much in the book, but it's quite interesting that a lot of religious people think that the true human freedom, there's a big tradition, is true human freedom is a kind of submission to the will of God. Do you see what I mean? So you recognize that there's something which has an authority over you, something you should follow. And I think the broader point about that is that I think a lot of the time in a kind of, if you want to call it a consumer society, we always think of freedom as being, you know, to choose whatever you want. But I think the key point is that meaningful freedom, there's got to be a reason why you choose what you do. And a lot of the time, if you look at the reasons for the choices we have, we can choose, again, not to do things. And we can choose to restrict what we do rather deliberately. You know, we can, if you're trying to lose weight, for example, you will deliberately restrict the options you have in your house. You don't stuff it full of cakes in the fridge, for example.
Julian, can I just ask you briefly about what, if you talk to people, I mean, it's interesting, we sort of reflect on politics and issues that touch on things like, I don't know, public health would be relevant, talking about, you know, how people eat and how they behave in that way. When you talk to people who maybe work in public services or in politics, this sort of thing, is it a challenge because you're dealing with ideas that are heavyweight? They are in the abstract. Do they almost sort of ask you to be more prescriptive with things? I wonder whether if you talk to people in those fields, they say, well, yes, 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 we understand this is very insightful, but how do we change people's behaviour, or how do we make them understand they need to do X and Y and Z? Or is that not a pressure that you feel? It, just because you write in an accessible way about these very abstract ideas.
To be honest, I think that the kind of people you're talking about often don't come to this kind of thing. As simple as that. And it is interesting. I've spoken to various sort of, you know, philosophically minded politicians over the time when I was doing philosophy.
Some.
And there are a lot, but they all say that the problem is that, first of all, it's not a good thing to flag that up in public life. Oliver Letwin, for example, did a PhD on Kant. And, you know, he doesn't let people know that too easily. The other thing is that when people get engaged in the nitty-gritty of politics at any kind of level, the practicalities take over. And a lot of people, they go into it wanting to be really thoughtful, reflective people. Gordon Brown was a very well-read guy, you know, and everything. But, you know, once you get into that hot seat, the pragmatics and necessities of getting on with things are pressing. And in a sense, that's fair enough. So I kind of think there's a kind of division of labour in politics. You know, I think these ideas can end up having an impact in the end, but they have to kind of come in sideways. You know, by the time it gets to the politicians, you've got to basically have a straightforward policy which makes sense and will be seen to work. The philosophical underpinnings of it by that point, it's like a scaffold that has to be taken away by the time it arrives at, you know, in Westminster.
Fascinating insights. That's Julian Bargini. The book is Freedom Regained, The Possibility of a Free Will. Julian, great to speak with you. Thanks very much for coming to see us on the Monocle Weekly. Andrew, I'd say time for some musical entertainment next up on the Weekly. Do you want some dreamy sounds?
Oh, yes, please.
This then is Vinyl Williams from Los Angeles with World Soul.
Contact.
That was very nice indeed. That was Viola Williams with World Soul. We'll be talking to Brian Cathcart about the changing face of newspaper reporting next.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Brian Cathcart is a journalist with not only his eye on the news, but on the ways in which we experience and receive those stories too. That's part of his job as Professor of Journalism at Kingston University. But Cathcart's dedication to the industry means he's also been on the founding staff of the Independent newspaper, served as a columnist for the New Statesman, and the last time we spoke to him on Monocle 24, he was spearheading the Hacked Off campaign, pushing for a public inquiry into press standards.
Brian came to Midori House a little bit earlier this week to talk about storytelling from a very different era. Cathcart's new book, The News from Waterloo, describes the haphazard journey of the news of Napoleon's defeat on its way back to the UK in 1815, an era when journalism was in its infancy.
Brian, thanks for coming to see us on the Monocle Weekly. Great to speak with you. Great to have you back, I should say, at Midori House, of course. Talk to us a little bit about The News from Waterloo, because this isn't really a history book per se. It's not just a book about the reportage of great events, but it's sort of about how those things meet. But it certainly offers up a fascinating glimpse at how different the world of reporting used to be, even surrounding a very famous event.
Yes. I mean, the origin of the book is I teach journalism and I was teaching some journalism history. And I was looking for an example for modern undergraduates aged 19 or 20 or whatever of how news travelled before we had electricity and indeed before we had steam. And I wanted to show just how it worked. And I looked up Waterloo because it seemed to be the obvious point before both of those things. And there really wasn't a clear story. And then I tried a little harder and you end up with 350 pages of book. But, I mean, it does have its origin in wanting to illustrate something about now. And it's about the relationship partly between news and technology. You know, we all talk now about this relationship between news and technology. We all think about our smartphones buzzing in our pockets when there is an earthquake in Nepal or whatever. We know these things very quickly and somehow automatically. And it's more recent in, as it were, human evolution than you might think that we had any kind of serious technology to speed news along. I'm also very interested in the way that the technology changed the news. One of the most revealing things to me and unexpected things to me about reading the newspapers from the period of Waterloo, and London was brimming with newspapers then. It's really quite surprising. There are probably 56 titles being published on a regular basis in London at that time, that they didn't do reporting. So a newspaper was an office, usually on the Strand or on Fleet Street, where people basically waited for stuff to come in. Or they went out and they looked for it, not in the sense of wanting to bear witness to events, but in the sense of finding stuff they could aggregate, as we would think of it today. Mm. So in those days, the editors just didn't think of sending anybody to Belgium to report on this enormously important campaign against Napoleon. They just sat in their offices and waited for something to arrive.
Brian, can I ask you then? It's interesting that rather sort of provokes, if you like, the observation that maybe we're, if not going full circle, but we've kind of arrived back at the same thing. People talk about newspapers, of course, your industry, formerly my own as well. One could almost facetiously say that some of them are trying this model where a reporter-free way of doing news. Are we coming back to something that approaches that, where some news services are aggregators, they're composites, and they're not actually interested in the spark, the creative part, if you like, of the newspaper production process?
I think in many senses we are. I suppose the moral I draw is that we shouldn't regard this relationship between reporting and news, which I think we've, generation after generation, we've come to believe that it was more or less the same thing, reporting, news, journalism, all one bag, but actually quite distinct parcels historically. And as you say, maybe going that way again, if you look at Google, for example, and you, as a news aggregator, you go to the news slot and you see the news pulled together from various free sources, but they're not primarily generators of news, they're simply relaying. That's a bit what the newspapers were like back then. And we're just being reminded that these things are different. They don't have to be in the same place. Now, is reporting dead? I don't think so. I think we need people to go and find the stuff that's hard to get hold of, that people are trying to hide from us. We need people to go and bear witness and see terrible things. But in terms of being told clunky things, most of the time we're happy to be told them more or less directly by the people who generate the news. Mm-hmm. So if you're a sports fan and you're following your team, you don't need a reporter, a radio reporter as it once was, to tell you who's injured or what the lineup will be for tomorrow's game. You can actually get that sent to you by the club. Now, that's a very low-level kind of news, but we're certainly in a world where that relationship is in question. And I don't think, frankly, the trend is very much in favour of journalists and reporters being the same thing and having a sort of handle, them having the handle on the news in the way that we saw in the past.
Well, let's look at the example, of course, which is the news from Waterloo. It's the title of the book. Tell us a little bit about the problems then that was presented by this passage of, you know, the news from the event that as it unfolded on the ground to how people learned of it, because the book is a chronology. We go sort of day by day through this extraordinary story. And the tribulations that are on the way are quite extraordinary. I guess that's a good place to start. Did you decide that it had to be a chronology to really capture the lunacies, the insanities of this extraordinary journey of this important information?
It's so tangled that you have to take it in small steps. So it's not just, I mean, essentially there are 4 days here. So the battle happens on the Sunday. The official news reaches London close to midnight on the Wednesday. Now that's unbelievable. That's, if you calculate it, the average speed, given the time when the battle ended and the time when the message arrived in London, the average speed at which the official news travelled from battlefield to central London is 3 miles an hour, which is walking speed.
At a gentle pace
as well. At a reasonably gentle pace, exactly. So why is it so slow? Well, of course, they don't have any steam or electricity to help it on its way. There are also a lot of human reasons why it's slow. Wellington sends the official dispatch to London. He does not send a short message saying, I've won a big battle, you know, it's all over for Napoleon. He sits down in the early hours of the following morning and begins a 2,500 word full account of the battle. This takes him until lunchtime to write. In fact, I think that's pretty quick, and I'm a professional writer. This takes him until lunchtime. He then presents it to a clerk who writes a fair copy, and that is given to an aide-de-camp, who is given them the mission to take it to London. So it's, 16 or 17 hours after the battle before the message actually starts to move. And that is to do with the conventions of the time. It's to do with the character of Wellington. He doesn't have any particular deference for government ministers or, you know, what mattered to him was that Napoleon was beaten. When people found this out, it didn't really matter. Napoleon knew.
Well, let me ask you about that, because one would imagine, therefore, and you document this very exhaustive process that he takes to report this in detail. It's a kind of early example, if you like, of slow journalism, sort of voguish notion at the moment.
Long form, you might say.
But you would imagine, therefore, that the account and how it would then subsequently be relayed would at the very least be accurate, and everyone would agree about it, because you had this very authentic hand from the key protagonist, if you like. But even that wasn't the story. So how come the story subsequently became this sort of fractured and fragmented thing?
One of the curious things is, of course, that Wellington didn't have any competition, or felt he didn't have any competition. There was competition. There were other means by which news was travelling, but they're unofficial. And for a variety of reasons, some of them sort of comical, Londoners get very mixed messages in those middling days. So it turns out that really he doesn't have much competition, because people decide they're only going to believe the official message when it arrives. Now, that leaves him in a very powerful position. Basically, he can tell it the way he wants it. He had a particular way that he wanted it told, and indeed, he was to stick by that for 20 or 30 years. He was to discourage anybody writing a new history. His 2,500-word account was effectively the official history of the Battle of Waterloo in this country for 20 or 30 years. Quite a remarkable thing. And yes, it contains mistakes, distortions. It is his perspective. I mean, I don't think he's cynical, But it is his perspective. And of course, there are other perspectives. Indeed, there is an entire industry of military historians developing alternative perspectives all the time on Waterloo. It is a fantastically well-recorded 8 or 9 hours of human experience.
And Brian, did you find that those conflicting accounts, as they emerged, even latterly, were equally compelling? Someone who's obviously fascinated by the events as they unfold, was there interest to be found in even the most sort of outlandish of the theories? Because I imagine, as you describe Wellington's victory, his approach, I guess that old trope of, you know, history being written by the winners, presumably he would have been an advocate or was one of the pioneers of that attitude. But do you think that some of the dissenting voices or alternative versions did have something compelling to offer the historian, the journalist, the writer after the fact, as you are?
I mean, there are, as you say, many alternative perspectives of Waterloo, and they provide a very rich source. It's worth bearing in mind the interest in Waterloo was huge, so huge that people flocked to the battlefield in the months and years afterwards in great numbers. Also, there was a lot of publishing. So I say Wellington's was the only version. That's incorrect, really. But it was the only British version of any substance. But there were books published which carried Napoleon's account of Waterloo, as well as Wellington's, as well as the Prussian account, as well as the Dutch account. It was a multinational engagement, and in that sense gave a variety of perspectives. There wasn't, I don't think, a great sort of critical interest in the battle, but they did want to wallow in it. If you read Wellington's account, it's extremely sober. This is not a gleeful account. First of all, partly because he's lost quite a lot of friends in this battle. It's an unusually sanguinary battle, as they called it back then. But it's also a somber account because that's his way, and he doesn't crow. He knows that having won, that's all he needed to say. He just needed to get down the narrative, praise the appropriate people, so far as he could remember who did what, and the appropriate units, so that ordinary soldiers got credit, as it were, in the dispatch. But so sober is it that when the American ambassador in London read it, he thought that Wellington was actually covering up a defeat. Wellington himself was very shocked by the casualties, and that comes through. Our losses are immense, he said. And he mourns, I mean, several individuals who were close friends of his in the dispatch. He clearly grieves for some time afterwards for these losses. That comes through quite strongly. It's a moving document in many ways.
The book is The News from Waterloo, The Race to Tell Britain of Wellington's Victory. It's an excellent book. Its author is Brian Cathcart. Brian, thanks very much for coming to tell us all about it on the Monocle Weekly.
A great pleasure.
Up next on the Monocle Weekly, we're going to be talking to Heidi Blake about Qatar and its ugly plot to buy the World Cup.
In a competitive and ever-modernizing world, artisan producers are staying resilient and challenging mass production. Monocle Films visits entrepreneurs in Istanbul, Cape Town and Mallorca who champion the art of craft.
The biggest focal point is how can I make this thing as hardy as possible? All these materials over time will just soften and darken and start picking up blemishes and start telling their own story.
Making a Point, premiering now in the film section of Monocle.com.
The 2022 World Cup will be played in Qatar, the small desert country that before the announcement of its success had barely any football infrastructure, inferno-like in impractical summer weather, and situated within an often conflict-racked region. It didn't really make sense. In fact, the entire tournament has been moved from its traditional summer kickoff, being played in the winter for the Qatar event due to those searing temperatures. So how do such strange decisions get made? Alleged corruption has dogged the Qatar decision since it first materialised.
Those allegations have been compounded by the work of Sunday Times journalists Heidi Blake and Jonathan Calvert, who received a cache of millions of documents detailing the corruption that goes on within football's governing body, FIFA, headed by controversial president Sepp Blatter. Their new book, The Ugly Game, The Qatari Plot to Buy the World Cup, will be difficult reading for those enamoured with football's optimistic image. Tom met co-author of the book, Heidi Blake, a little earlier.
Heidi, thanks very much for coming to speak to us on the Monocle Weekly about the ugly game. I guess we'll talk about the adventure of being part of this book in a moment, but I wanted to start by asking about the first moment when you actually got access to all of the extraordinary archive, you know, these millions of documents and materials. Was it, I mean, I guess it was pretty obvious, pretty apparently, as you write, exactly what you had, But did you really sort of realise the magnitude of what was in your possession and what it was going to reveal?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's funny, actually. I keep this line-a-day diary where you can go back and look at what you were doing this time a year ago. And it was a little bit more than a year ago that we first got hold of the documents. And I was reading back on it and seeing that very early on, I was kind of writing, we have this extraordinary cache of documents. This is going to be huge. You know, this is an enormous story. I think it was fairly immediately apparent that it was going to be really, really explosive. I mean, the whistleblower who provided the documents had said to us, you know, look, Qatar has always said that Mohammed bin Hammam wasn't really working for them, but these documents show that he was, and he was playing a crucial role. And we wondered the extent to which we were going to find that that was true. But I mean, we began reading and running search terms through the documents and very quickly realised that he was a pivotal figure, that he was running a really concerted campaign on behalf of Qatar. And from that point onwards, we realised we were really onto something huge.
Something really significant. And I wonder then, when you sort of almost kind of went to ground, you had this cache of documents, you had to sort of make sure it was safe, make sure you guys were safe. Did you have to change your working practices even from other investigative work that you'd done before? And I mean, was it kind of scary, I guess I'm asking you, at that time?
It was. I mean, at first it was really exciting, and it felt kind of like an adventure to be displaced from our office in London and to have to decamp to this secret location. And it was quite a lot of fun. And then it gradually became more and more grueling, because the deadline, you know, we knew we had to release the stories before the World Cup for maximum impact. And the deadline was rushing closer and closer. And we just realised the magnitude of the task, just trying to trawl this, you know, literally hundreds of millions of documents. And so we kind of, weekends were cancelled, evenings were cancelled. We were just there the entire time.
It's a fun business, journalism, isn't it, at times?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was a kind of big adventure. It was incredibly hard work, but incredibly absorbing. And yeah, we just got totally obsessed. And it's a huge luxury to have such a wealth of fascinating source material to be delving into. And, you know, as a journalist, you spend a lot of your time scrabbling around, looking for source material, trying to get hold of that one explosive document. And so to have millions of documents was just, you know, it's extraordinary.
And tell me about how then, when it came time to sort of tell the story, you mentioned the rush, you know, sort of before the book, to get the initial information out there through the pages of the newspaper. Where did you start? Was it about doing a bit of a sort of forensic hatchet job on, you know, Mohammed bin Hammam? Was it about casting as much light as possible on the murky dealings that informed the Qatar decision? How did you decide where to focus for maximum impact? Or was that an agenda that was set by your editors, for example?
No, I mean, we were pretty much kind of out there on our own working out what to look for. And because of the hugely voluminous nature of the material, we had to narrow it down by running searches using this forensic search technology to narrow down the material. And so we began really by running searches for the names and email addresses of all of the 24 members of FIFA's executive committee. So that was the kind of the first thing we did, so we could see what sort of contact Bin Hammam was having with them in the 2-year period leading up to the World Cup vote. And that was how we very quickly saw that he was lobbying them, you know, frenetically to support the bid. And we discovered various other ways of narrowing things down. So we discovered that there were payments being made from Bin Hammam's his construction company, it was a company called Chemco in Doha, and that the accounts staff at Chemco would email payment bank transfer slips to a man called Najib Chirakal, who was Bin Hammam's assistant, and Chirakal would send them on to the officials who had been paid with a note from Bin Hammam saying, you know, thanks so much for supporting our World Cup bid and here's 50 grand. And so we began to just run searches for the email addresses of those Chemco account staff, and that uncovered this rich seam of dozens and dozens, scores of these sorts of payments. So that's kind of how we filtered down into it. And then as we worked, we built a huge timeline of all of Bin Hammam's activities, and a clear picture began to emerge of the campaign he was waging.
And that campaign is documented with all of this forensic detail in the book. What I sort of struck me while I was reading it is, wow, this is as damning as I remembered, you know, from reading the reports in the paper. It is all there in black and white. And yet, you know, it doesn't seem to have changed anything. When you look at the big picture, it still seems like this World Cup's going to go ahead, we suspect. It still seems like Sepp Blatter's sitting in his office. Most of these people, aside from Bin Hammam, who's kind of in this weird semi-self-imposed exile in Doha, why haven't heads rolled? Why hasn't anything more fundamental changed? Are you surprised that has happened, or was that rather what you suspected as you began to dig into all of this murk that surrounds it?
You know, look, FIFA is probably, it's certainly among the most robustly unaccountable organisations in the world. And that's partly because of the man at the head of the organisation, Sepp Blatter, who just refuses to listen to any. And, you know, when he feels that FIFA is being criticised, he kind of attacks the messenger, and he said, "We were accused of racism when we published our stories," rather than him actually engaging with the evidence. But we've been investigating FIFA on and off for several years now, you know, the Sunday Times Insight team. And so this wasn't a new area for us. And we'd uncovered evidence before that the Qatar World Cup bid had offered the son of one of the FIFA voters $1 million to host a dinner, which was actually the story that kicked off the whole Michael Garcia, you know, inquiry by FIFA's in-house investigator. And we'd sort of seen how that evidence was just kicked into the weeds and nothing had really happened with it. So we didn't have hugely high hopes. But as we began to really get our heads around the scale of the evidence that we had, we felt that there was going to be such an avalanche, you know, of proof that this process was corrupted that they just wouldn't be able to ignore it. We really did. And so we did expect that they were going to have to do something. We thought they were going to have to rerun the vote. And we wondered whether Blatter would survive or would he have to resign. And we thought that he ought to resign because he's presided over this totally corrupt process. But actually, it was astonishing to see the way that FIFA just stonewalled. And as I say, we were... You know, Blatter stood up about a week after we published our first story and accused us of discrimination and racism for writing about corruption in countries other than Britain. And then FIFA basically just refused to engage or to comment at all on anything that we'd published. And of course, subsequently, Michael Garcia, the investigator, I mean, he announced pretty quickly after we published our evidence that he was bringing the evidence gathering phase of his investigation to a rapid close before he'd had a chance to look at the millions of documents that we had. So he never took account of anything in the FIFA files before he submitted his final report, which of course said that Qatar and Russia had done nothing wrong in the way that they secured the tournament. And so that's sort of the end of that. And it's incredibly frustrating.
How much do you think, I mean, you paint this extraordinary picture of Mohammed bin Hammam as the sort of this driving character who's at the centre of this narrative through all of this controversy. And obviously his own ambition maybe undermined him ultimately. He himself tried to sort of get to the upper reaches of the game using any means necessary. Do you think that the outcome might have been different had he not made some decisions that he made later in the day when, you know, he was in this sort of his own battle, if you like, with Sepp Blatter? Could we have seen a different outcome within FIFA, do you think, if he'd not decided to, for example, look for the top job in that institution himself?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because in lots of ways it's almost it's a sort of semi-Shakespearean story of hubris, really, that Bin Hammam really overreached himself by trying to topple Blatter and therefore was destroyed in the process. But I mean, I think also that what we picked up from lots and lots of conversations with people very close to Bin Hammam in the course of researching the book, but also people inside FIFA, was that after Qatar won the rights to host the World Cup, Blatter was really quite alarmed, because although he promised his support to Qatar early on, he really didn't think it was going to be possible for Bin Hammam to pull off this campaign, you know, persuading FIFA to send the World Cup to a country where it was actually too hot even to play football in the summer. It was just preposterous, but somehow Bin Hammam had done it. And I think Blatter got quite rattled and thought, well, he's obviously far more powerful than I'd realised. So Blatter then sort of begins, if you look at what happened after, to kind of chisel away at Qatar's World Cup. And he announced sort of almost immediately that it was probably going to have to be played in the winter, which caused an outcry in Europe. And then he came out and said that Qatar and Spain had made an illegal collusion deal and that he knew this had happened, which was an extraordinary thing to claim. And so then he announced that there was going to be an independent corruption panel which would look at the governance of FIFA and try and stamp out wrongdoing. And I think Bin Hammam started to panic, and basically a decision was taken that Blatter had turned into an enemy and that he needed to be stopped, and Bin Hammam was going to have to challenge him in order to protect the long-term goal of having the World Cup in Qatar, because it kind of looked like Blatter was maybe going to interfere with that. But obviously, having challenged Blatter, you know, Bin Hammam ultimately didn't survive that, because, you know, it seems that Blatter set about trying to bring him down.
And he was just too good at it. It's interesting, you talk about this long look that you've been taking, you and your colleagues alike, at FIFA, at Blatter, all of these individuals. There's a huge amount of money, obviously. The game is awash with it. It's a widely offered refrain about the problems of the game. It's changed beyond recognition since all this money came in. Is it kind of rotten at its core? Do you fear for the governance of the game and the game's longer-term security if there's not the kinds of structural significant changes that we were just saying haven't happened as a result of this? Do you sort of despair when you look to the future?
I do despair when I look to the future of FIFA, because I think, I mean, it is an endemically corrupt organisation, unfortunately, and I think that's because you have, you know, rife corruption at the national level where kind of football association presidents, I mean, so many of them were taking Bin Hammam's money, dozens and dozens and dozens of them, and so many of them have gone completely unpunished for it. And these people, often these are people who've been embezzling money from their national football associations for years, or who've been taking backhanders, and they don't want to see FIFA cleaned up because that would end the gravy train for them. So the last thing they want is to vote for somebody other than Blatter, who might actually be a new broom and try and sweep out the corruption. And so it's a sort of self-perpetuating thing. They're going to keep re-electing Blatter, and all the while Blatter's there, nothing's going to change, and he's going to continue turning a blind eye to this sort of thing. And there's no higher authority in world sport who could actually step in and regulate FIFA. They are the highest authority in world football, and they're incorporated in Switzerland, which is probably, you know, the world's most secretive jurisdiction, in a country where they're actually registered as a not-for-profit organisation, hilariously, despite their billions and billions of dollars.
Delicious irony, all of that.
Revenues.
So I just wonder then, what happens next? You obviously had a whistleblower that provided all of this material. Do you think that the ultimate, it's hard to describe it as a failure, but I mean, the revelations are so powerful, but the fact that nothing really significant changed within FIFA, would that be your fear that that might deter other whistleblowers or other people who might have other documents or other proof from coming forwards in the future?
I mean, I really hope not. I'm Jonathan Calvert, and I, he's my co-author in the book. We're both hugely, hugely grateful to the whistleblower who gave us these documents for his enormous bravery in doing so. And we really hope there are other people who, when they see corruption, will be brave enough to stand up and to come forward and bring it to light. And I think that all the while there is corruption flourishing inside that organisation, there will be good people in the room who are not happy about it and who want to see things cleaned up, because they actually genuinely, they're there because they love football. And so I hope it doesn't deter people from coming forward, and I hope that people continue working away at trying to clean it up. But I just think it's a very long way from getting very much better.
Heidi Blake, the book is The Ugly Game, The Qatari Plot to Buy the World Cup, by Heidi and Jonathan Calvert. It's out now. It's a terrific read. Heidi, thanks for coming to tell us all about it. And that just about does it for this 304th, count them, Andrew, edition of the Monocle Weekly.
When we were speaking to Julian, who I really enjoyed meeting, he raised the question that people have, like, this kind of notion of free will. It's like either biscuit or bun. I did want to put my hand up when he raised that, because I don't think you have a different version of that. Biscuit and bun.
100%. That's free will right there for me.
He needs to do a new book.
He needs to, yeah, or a third option, a third subcategory of people. So he's dealt with psychopaths, the criminally insane. He needs to deal with the enthusiastically hungry.
You'd mess up all of his research, I think.
I'm very happy to be operating outside that Venn diagram, Andrew, as I am in so many ways.
Well, a very nice show. I'm sorry I wasn't here to meet Brian Cathcart. I used to work with Brian Cathcart at The Independent on Sunday before I joined Monocle, and very nice man. And that book looks great.
What was particularly fascinating about it, not just the story, the detail of this, the journey of this news, which, I mean, as he pointed out, it was basically slower than if someone had just walked back, but how it's still relevant to the way that news gathering and the way that news aggregation and all these things work today, which, I mean, given his work as a teacher of journalism, is unsurprising. But yeah, really super interesting.
And we also were impressed that we understood everything that Julian talked about. Off air, we said to him, that's the skill, is, you know, not just having a kind of a whacking big brain, but being able to explain in really kind of digestible, enjoyable ways the things that you know.
Well, I said to him, I said, if I can even understand 1/50th of this, then that's something of a triumph.
Okay, I'm going to go buy you a biscuit and a bun.
Lovely stuff. Let's thank the producers, the Eminence Grease behind the Monocle Weekly, our producer Tom Hall, and also our studio manager Claire Barn. And not forgetting our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The Weekly will be back again next week. I'm not sure who'll be in the chairs, Andrew. Maybe you, maybe me, maybe Rob.
I'm going to be here.
Andrew will be here.
I want my chair.
But from me, Tom Edwards, for now.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's goodbye.